Let's give a warm welcome to our warm-up speaker, Gabe.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Gabe. I'm an alcoholic. And a little nervous here. I'm not used to sharing at a big meeting like that. But anyway, grateful to be in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and be participating in a meeting because... you know, it's hard to participate in meetings sometimes. You know, you could be there, but you're not there, if you know what I mean. And, you know, when I first started Alcoholics Anonymous, I was brought here by the law, by the judge. And I would say, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not for me. That's for other people, you know, people that are out in, asking for money asking for money or for this or for that, or, you know, it just wasn't for me. And I came because I had to. I actually, the first month or so, I tried to hunt down a bunch of meetings and offering people, you know, secretaries money to sign my card. And nobody would do it. They said, you know what, you come when you're ready. And I go, okay. And I was like, whatever. And so I finally went to my first meeting and I go, that's okay. It was a speaker meeting like this one. And I was like, all right. You know, I didn't like it too much. And I went to another meeting. I didn't like it too much. And I went to one meeting. I heard some guys talking about some stuff, you know, saying part of what I went through, part of my story. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. So I went back again, and I went back again. And I started hearing more and more things that I could identify with it, you know, that was part of my story or things I went through. And I was like, man, you know what, this is pretty cool. And I was sober for a couple months when I first came in, and then I was like, you know what? I think everything's under control now. I can't control my drinking. I'm going to have a few beers. So I had a few beers one night. And the second night, I was like, well, I can have a few more beers tonight. I didn't get drunk last night. I got drunk the next day, and I was like, oh, crap, you know, I got pretty messed up last night. You know, I'm a blackout drunk drinker. I'll drink till the wheels fall off is what I say. So, for the first year and a half or so, I did that. You know, I stayed sober for 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever, and I'd go back out again. And you know, it wasn't, every time I went back out, I was like, man, it sucks, man, but I can't, you know, it sucks out there. It sucks drinking. It sucks drinking when you don't want to drink. And I'm not going to drink today, okay? And then the evening would come around, and, you know, you see your people you work with or whatever, they're all having a cold beer. And I was like, man, why not, you know? And so, you know, it took a while for me to actually want to stay sober. You know, it took a while for me to, I was tired of being tired, but I wasn't tired of, you know, I still didn't want to let go. And anyway, my drinking started in my childhood. You know, all my family members drink. I mean, it's alcohol, alcoholism throughout all my family. You know, my dad, my uncles, on both sides of the family, they're all alcoholics, you know. They don't think they're alcoholics, but now that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, I know they're alcoholics. before I thought it was just a social thing. You know, I always thought, you know, alcohol, you know, that's the only way you can have fun. You know, you can't have a good time without alcohol. And so, you know, I was curious as a kid, you know, 5, 6 years old, you know, I'd see everybody drinking, and, you know, they'd leave the little studs, and, you know, I'd drink them behind my dad's back and his friends, and I'd even take a couple hits of the cigarette or whatever. And my mom, they have a couple wine coolers with my aunt, and you know, a couple are at our family gatherings, and I take a sip, and I like the feeling, because, you know, I was still kind of tingly and warm, and I was like, man, this is pretty cool. Anyway, the first time I actually intended to get drunk was, you know, I grew up, I was the youngest, it was my brother, it's 3 years older than me, my cousin 3 years older than me, there was, you know, I was the youngest by 3 years, and I always was, grew up with older, you know, older family members. So one time, intentionally, I go, hey, I want to get drunk today. They're like, okay. So, you know, we're at my uncle's house, and he always bought a bunch of cases of beer. And I remember it was Budweiser, and he had an extra case right there in the little room. And so we started drinking. I remember I thought it was cool. I was pounding them. Boom, one. And then as soon as I drink one, I have to go take a piss. And then I drink another one, I have to go take a leak again. Then I remember my seventh one, boom, I foul. And I was like, wow. So, and I drank seven, I fell. And I was like, man, what's going on? And so they picked me up, they drug me inside, they took me a shower or whatever. And the next day, I wake up with pee up to here to me, and I was like, wow, man, what happened? I was sick for 3 days, throwing up and throwing up. Like, I'm never going to drink again. You know, this is my last time, my first and last. I'll never drink again. Well, a couple months later, it's my my cousin's graduation, and there I am again, you know, drinking. And you know, I'd get drunk, and, you know, I liked it. Well, so, you know, I did that for years. You know, I'd hang out with my cousins and stuff, and, you know, we'd drink. And so by the time I got into high school, when I was 2 days for my 12th birthday, I forgot to talk about that. Also, I lost my dad, sadly but truly, you know, I lost him to I've learned here the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction, and you know, I never really, I don't know, it just opened my eyes in here, but I'll go on with that. But so I grew up, you know, I went for a few more years. You know, I grew up more and more, and I was like, man, I grew up confused because I was like, well, I don't have my dad, you know, it's okay. And the only person, the only people I could relate with was with my uncles, which they drank, and you know, did other things, and my brother were probably, you know, the only ones I could kind of relate with. So, you know, I drink with them, and I don't know, I think it was more of a comfort with them because we'd sit there and they let me cry, and I grew up thinking men that cry are, you know, they're wusses. You know, you're not supposed to cry unless you're intoxicated. Then you could cry, you know, because I seen my dad cry was when he was drunk. Otherwise, you know, he was Mr. Macho Man. And you know, when I grew up thinking that, up until, you know, a few months ago, I did some step work. I realized it's okay to cry. And you know, so to me, my dad, you know, he you know, for us, he did, you know, for him and my mom, you know, me and my siblings, to be honest, we never really, I could say we never needed anything because they always worked their asses off for us, you know what I mean? And I always thought, you know, you have to work and work and work, and you know, from Sunday or sunlight to sundown, and you know, the evening, you know, you have a few beers or whatever, the weekends get drunk. So I grew up thinking all that. So I lost, you know, my dad, he passed away from that, and from alcohol poisoning and an overdose also. And so I grew up confused, like, is that good? Is that, you know, I mean, is it okay to drink? And so, you know, I was always like, I'm never going to be that person. And, you know, sure enough, I started drinking more and more and more and more. By the time I was in high school, you know, I was out drinking all my brother and his buddies already, you know, and I was a freshman and they were seniors, and I was already out drinking them, and you know, I thought I was badass because I could drink more than them. And so I went on through high school like that. You know, I always worked because as a child, you know, we got beat if we didn't work. So I always worked. You know, I'd work in the afternoons or work on the weekends or whatever. So, you know, my mom, she got me a truck or whatever, and, you know, I'd make payments on it, and so, you know, I thought it was okay. And my mom, you know, she never really told us nothing, and I think because she's here now, so that's why. I think the reason being is because she felt she couldn't tell us them because, you know, because my dad wasn't there, and up until now I realize all this stuff. And anyway, so with my, I grew up and, you know, just drinking, and you know, I did the drinking, the selling, the using, the girls, the trucks, and I did all that, and I thought I was living it up. And, you know, after high school, you know, everybody kind of went to school. Everybody did their own thing. And you know, I worked, but I didn't really go for an education. I never really paid attention in school. And you know, I just worked and drank, just the way my family members were. That's what my dad did. That's what I did. That's what my uncle did. That's what I did, work and drink. And I got a job offer in Bakersfield. I went over to Bakersfield. And, you know, I'd come down on the weekends. And I would come down on the weekends and I had supposedly come down to visit my family, and I wouldn't visit my family. All I do is go drop my dirty clothes off to my mom's, and I take off and go party all weekend. And then I'd come down Saturday afternoon, and my mom wouldn't see me till Sunday night, drunk as hell, you know, walking in the door, and then she'll just wake me up, you know, at 4 a.m. to leave Monday morning, and there I went. So, you know, I did that for about 2.5 years, and most of the time it was with close friends or my brother or my uncles, You know, and the reason why I'm trying to, I keep mentioning them, because to them, you know, I realize here, the reason why I think I hang around with them more, because I could express my feelings with them without being ashamed of my feelings. I could cry in front of them. And, you know, and then in 2007, my brother passed away in a car accident. And that did me even more, I guess, led me to drink even more, made it more okay for me to drink, opened more doors, more excuses for things, more pity for me. And so I you know, and then my mom's like, well, you ought to come back home so you can spend time with your brother's kids. And I go, okay, I will. And, you know, that was even worse for me. I got home and I started working for the family business, and then it escalated from there. It got worse and worse and worse, you know, and I started, you know, I wouldn't go to work on Monday morning. Oh, my, you know, they covered for me. You know, it's okay. He was, you know, he got a little too drunk last night or whatever. And then it went into Tuesday. Then it went into Wednesday. And I was like, man, and then, you know, then I was like, man, this is getting kind of, you know, it's not fun. You know, I don't want to not go to work. And, you know, I say, you know what, okay, this is it. I'm not going to drink it throughout all the week. You know, today's Monday morning, I'm done. And then Thursday, I'd be drunk. And then those Thursdays came into Wednesday. You know, it go on, and it just got worse and worse. And right now, we're just talking, we were over dinner. You know, we practice a Catholic religion, and right now we're fasting for Lent. And I remember for about 3-4 years, I always gave up, you know, I'm not going to drink for Lent. And about a week later, I was like, well, I said I was going to drink beer, not tequila, so I'll drink some tequila. And so I did that every year, and then New Year's Eve. This is how I know I'm an alcoholic. Also, you know, all those are reasons I know I'm an alcoholic. Or New Year's, you know, I'd be drunk as hell with somebody. Hey, man, my New Year's resolution, I'm not going to drink this year. And you know, I start off drunk, and every year I did it. And anyway, it got old, and I got to real bad place. I'd be alone by myself. After my brother passed away, I kind of led away from family, close friends, and I just started hanging around with, you know, people that I could, I guess, that didn't look down on me or didn't, you know, to me, that's what I felt at least, you know, that, you know, they're, you know, they can't really judge me, you know, because, you know, they're alcoholics also. That's kind of what I thought. They have a problem too, and I knew I had a problem, but I thought I could somewhat control it. At that time, I already knew I had a problem. And for years, you know, I knew that I needed some help, but I couldn't. I was like, well, I never knew there was where to seek help. And I wasn't going to tell my mom. I wasn't going to tell none of my family members that I had a problem, or that I knew I had a problem. And sure enough, you know, I within 2 months, I went to jail 3 times. And it seemed like as soon as the law got a hold of me, they didn't let me go. And my, you know, after I got out one time, my mom took me to rehab. I went to rehab, and my mom, my sisters, they took me to rehab, and I did that for about 4 months. You know, I thought I was healed. I was like, okay, I could drink now. I could control it. And I came out the first weekend, I started drinking, and then I got out of hand again. And then that's when the courts assigned me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I did Alcoholics Anonymous for a little bit. Not, you know, I guess I didn't really get into it. I wanted to stay sober, but I didn't want to do no work. They'd say, you know what, do step work, get a sponsor, talk to people, read the book. I was like, you know what, these people are so full of crap. How is doing step work, writing a piece of paper, help you feel better? You know, that's dumb. How's a book going to change your life? All these people talk about, read the book, it's going to change your life. I was like, man, those guys are so full of crap. And, you know, and finally, they always talk about, you know, what they call them, the dry drunks. They, you know, I'd always hear that, and then I hear it more and more, and I was like, you know what? I think I am a dry drunk, you know, because I'm an asshole. And so you know, I was like, you know what? I tried this. They're like, you need to get a sponsor. You get a sponsor. And, you know, I tried one guy, and I didn't really like him. And then I felt, you know, I tried one guy, and he tried to tell me what church I had to go to. He tried to tell me what, you know, how I had to talk, how I had to dress. I was like, you know what, screw this. I'm not going to have a sponsor. And so I walked away from him, and then I just did it on my own again, started sponsoring myself for about another 2 months, and then I started, like, getting close to drinking again. I was like, you know what, I need to find somebody. And I started talking to somebody else, and that guy, he ditched me all the time, and I was like, man, I really need to find somebody. And You know, I found the main speaker here, Bill. He's my sponsor, and you know, I always like to hear him speak. I always liked him, and then one time I asked him, I go, hey, you know what? Do you know anybody looking for a sponsor? You know, I kind of wanna. And I was beating around the bush. He goes, okay, wait a minute here. Let me ask you a question. Are you kind of asking me to be your sponsor? And I was like, yeah, but I know you have a lot of sponsors. I go, so I don't know if you're willing to sponsor me. And he goes, well, you know what? It's really not my choice. It's God's choice. If God leads you to me, then there's no way I could say no. You know what? That kind of touched me. I was like, okay, well, thank you. And so we started talking, and you know, he got to know a little bit more about me, and I got into some step work. But you know what? I never worked on something the way I you know, the way I started my step work. I hear what he says, what other people say about steps, and I was like, I want that. So I got into it pretty intense, and I've got a lot of stuff out of it. I'm barely on my fourth step. Unfortunately, I got really busy at work the last 3 weeks, and so I've only been doing a little bit of step work the last 3 weeks, and along with that, I kind of knew I was kind of lacking recovery a little bit, so I even, you know, along the way, last week, I took up a position in a, you know, in a meeting because I knew I needed it, and now, you know, there's one thing I too want to say, you know, one of the main things I think that my sponsor's done for me is, he's brought me a lot closer to God. I grew up, which is my higher power. I grew up in I went to a private school, and I you know, I always believed in God. But you know, I moved away from God. I guess I strayed away because I said, you know what? Well, God took away my dad. He took away my brother. He's taken away. He made me an alcoholic. He made me do this. He made me do that. And you know, so I believed in him and I prayed, but not really. You know what I mean? And you know, he opened my eyes big time about 3-4 weeks ago. He just took it to another level. And the day after he took me there, I was reading something on a daily reflection, and it said something about that God, you know, guides you to that person, and so I'm sitting, you know, I'm sitting in front of my yard, you know, ready to leave, and so I just read that, and I'm reading it, and I'm, you know, I'm saying my prayers before I leave to work, and then I start crying all of a sudden. I'm like, oh man, I start crying, and then I text him that morning, then I started crying again while I'm texting him, and I was like, my gosh, I can't stop crying, and then so I drive down the road and I start thinking about more stuff, you know, and I start crying again, and I was like, oh, like, you know, Bill, you, why'd you make me, why you, it's all your fault, you made me cry, and you know what, and I've been really emotional since then. I don't like to show my emotions all that much, but you know, it's been good for me. They're good emotions, nothing bad, that's for sure. And you know, I, through doing step work, I've opened my eyes quite a bit. I find a lot more about myself, about where I'm lacking. And I mean, it's unexplainable. So I mean, those of you that haven't got a sponsor, haven't done no step work, I strongly recommend it. You know, especially even if you're not ready to have a sponsor, maybe just at least talk to somebody. And because I know definitely talking to somebody does help. When you sponsor yourself the way I did for a couple of years, you know, you're just killing yourself, and it hurts even more because you have to live through it. There's nothing numbing you anymore. And I don't know. I'm grateful to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and grateful, you know, to have God in my life. He's definitely working in my life. You know, every night I take a minor inventory of all the good things, you know, that all the blessings I got that day, and ask, you know, and the bad things I did, ask for forgiveness. And you know what? You know, then tomorrow morning it'll be a nice fresh day. Start with new blessings, and I'm just very grateful for that. And I want to thank you guys. Thank Bill and Rick, is it? Yeah, for letting me share. And with that, I'll say thank you very much.
Guys, let's give a warm welcome for our featured speaker, Bill. And it's his birthday. Thank you.
tempted to update Facebook before I get started. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill Hatzman.
Hey, Bill.
Blessed beyond blessed beyond measure. I'm 3,285 days ago, this journey began for me 9 years ago today. Okay, now we got a lot of information, so I need to hold down. We're gonna go. You know, one of the things that that I've been taught by the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to be certain to say congratulations to Wanda. 34 years of continuous sobriety is really something, and she's been a great friend for all the 9 years, and the longer than 9 years that I've been coming to AA, and I'll tell you that Wanda is one of the examples that I can point to specifically of people who have shown me how to live a new way of life. And what I've heard Wanda and others talk about is how important prayer and meditation is in their life. And not just talking about prayer, but actually living prayer. I heard somebody say one time, pray incessantly and use words if necessary. You know, that kind of prayer. And I haven't quite mastered any of that yet, but I have learned a lot about prayer. And one of the things that I've grown to do is depend on it. And what I'd like to do, in the event that there's anyone here tonight who may, like I was, not be very familiar with prayer or how to do it or what it looks like, I'd like to share with you a prayer that I do most nights. I share this with my wife. One of the most important things I do as a married man with my wife is I lead our prayer in the evening, most evenings. And what I'd like to do is share that the most common version of that prayer with you, and I'd like to include you in it. And if you're here tonight and prayer is something that really bristles your skin or makes you uncomfortable, then please ignore what I'm about to do. But I hope you won't cheat yourself of that opportunity. So the prayer goes something like this. Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for another day sober here on earth. We thank you, Lord, for all of your blessings. We ask that you help us to see, share, and be good stewards with them all. We pray that you would help us to become the men and women that you'd have us be, that you would show us the path that you'd have us take, that you would help us to become willing to follow your way. Lord, we pray for all of your children, that they would come to know you, that they would find a relationship with you that, like ourselves, has introduced us to the ideas of love and peace and joy and freedom. And we pray, Lord, that you would use us to help build your kingdom here on earth, and that you would use us to help meet the needs of some of your kids, especially when we don't want to. And we pray for healing and for all those who are suffering, that they may find comfort in you. It's in your name that we pray. Amen. You know, funny thing about prayer, I've been told that sometimes some of the words we use can be upsetting to people. So I hope nothing I said offended anyone here tonight. And if it did, it might be a great opportunity for you to get a sponsor and talk to that person. I say that with a little jest. I'm not trying to be a hard ass, but that could turn out to be some very good advice. I want to tell you a little bit about my relationship with alcohol, because I think that's important, especially if there's anyone here tonight who hasn't found the solution to alcoholism that I've been shown. And one of the things that our book tries to do is it tries to describe some of the thinking and some of the ways of behaving that are common to alcoholics. And I think sometimes it's unfortunate that some people hear some things at AA meetings and they come to this conclusion that there are things that make a person alcoholic. Maybe you understand what I say when I be a little more specific. Like DUIs. or getting arrested, or losing a job, or losing a family, or losing a marriage. These are all things that sometimes people will point to and say are signs of alcoholism. And I hope if I do nothing else as I get started here, I hope that I can help you, if you have questions about those things, to see that that's not alcoholism at all. Those might be symptoms that an alcoholic might portray, but they certainly don't make a person alcoholic. And I think it's really important to get clear on what an alcoholic is and what an alcoholic isn't, because the solution that I found here really depended on me taking some specific actions. And I believe completely in my heart that the 12 steps that are outlined in this book have given me an entirely different life. And I hope that you find the same. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my drinking. One of the first memories I have with alcohol, I'm sure it wasn't the first time I drank, but it was one of the times I remember very early. I was going to a high school dance, and I should probably tell you a little story before that. I went to a junior high school dance before this. This was before I remember alcohol being involved, and I remember there was a girl in my class. Her name was Cindy Rushing. I don't know why I still remember that name. She had these cute little tortoiseshell glasses, and she was going to make me happy. And so on a Friday afternoon, I decided that I was going to go to this dance, and I was going to see Cindy, and I don't know what I was going to do with her, but she was going to be mine. And so I went home from school, and I took a shower. I did my hair up right. I got a nice shirt on. I put my dad's aftershave on. You know, I mean, I was really ready. And I got to that dance, and I don't know if some of the guys will relate to this. But I walked into that dance, and I saw Cindy standing there, and she was talking to some of her friends. And it seemed like just as I walked in, they started giggling. And I thought, well, did I wear the wrong shirt, or is my hair messed up, or what's wrong with me? Why is she laughing? And I made it all about me. And for all I know, she and her friends told a joke. I mean, who knows? But you know what I did is I cowered in fear. I never did talk to Cindy that night. I was afraid of being rejected. And so what I did is I stood with my back against the wall, and I watched a bunch of other people have fun. And I resented them all. And I wanted to be part, you know, and I felt like I was just not. I felt like I wasn't good enough. And I don't know where that comes from. And I don't think only alcoholics have that. Okay, but that was an experience I had before alcohol. Now let me tell you about the experience with alcohol. I'm in high school now, and a couple of the kids were on my swim team. They were a little bit older than me, so they had a car. I'm a freshman in high school. They picked me up. When they picked me up, I get in the back seat of the car, and there's we call it a tall boy, right? A 16-ounce can of beer in the back seat. And I don't know if there was peer pressure. I don't remember them ever even asking if I wanted it. I think I said, "Hey, can I have this?" thinking that I wanted to fit in, right, be part of their little fun crew. And so they gave me the beer, and look, I didn't like the taste of it. I choked the darn thing down. But you know what happened, man? I went to that dance, and I had the time of my life. I mean, I was asking some of the girls that had football player boyfriends to dance, you know. I was being silly. But I had a great time. And it wouldn't be until after doing some of the work that was prescribed in Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned that there was a tragic thing that happened that night. See, up until the time I had done that inventory work so many years later, I thought this was all just a great experience with a lot of fun. And what I learned is that while I got to I slept in my bed that night, there were no car accidents, there were no broken hearts, there was no money spent that I didn't have. You know, all the telltale signs of a problem didn't exist. But what did happen, see, is I began to live according to a new lie. And the lie that I began to live according to was that if I put alcohol in my system, you like me better. And I also believed another lie, and the other lie was that I liked me better. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to cheat you or me of that fantastic human being I become with a little alcohol, right? So, you know, I didn't have access to alcohol regularly as a young teenager. Occasionally it would come up, and some of my friends are here in the audience tonight, guys I grew up with, and we went to the parties out in the country like everybody else did, and you know, it really wasn't obvious that I had any kind of problem with alcohol until much, much later. And what happened is exactly what our book describes. Alcoholism is a progressive condition. And what happened for me is I began to rely on alcohol more and more. And I did it in such a subtle, slow way that I didn't even realize that I was doing it. And you know, now, so many years later, I look back and what started off as maybe a couple of times a year having an experience with alcohol turned into, I remember being in the Army and I had this refrigerator, and we thought it was so cute. We took pictures and videos of it, right? But my refrigerator would always be stacked full of beer, and we would just drink it like it was in short supply. And we went on some wonderful adventures. I mean, don't get me wrong. I had a great time drinking. I really like what alcohol does for me. It removes this wave of fear that I seem to inherently or instinctively carry around with me. And I'm not unique in that way. The thing is that when I was a teenager, and most of the people that were around me who weren't relying on alcohol to deal with those social anxieties, I never learned how to do that. I just learned how to depend on changing the way I feel. And so over the years, I began to drink more and more. One of the things that began to happen for me is, and some of you may relate to this, but I would wake up in the morning and I wasn't perfectly clear about some of the details from the night before. And again, some of the friends of mine that are in the audience may have been some of the voices on the phone. See, it was cute at first, right? It was like, dude, do you remember what you did last night? And of course, my answer was, I don't know. You know, or did I? And so it was funny, the silly things we do or say. And then it got to be not so funny over a period of time. And then it got, shall I say, pathetic? I mean, it got sad. It got embarrassing. And you know, I didn't even notice it, but a lot of the people that had come into my life would leave my life because they weren't signing up for that nonsense. You know, they didn't need idiots in their life, and so they'd go find other people who behaved more appropriately. And I didn't even notice I was gaining and losing friends. I had no idea that alcohol was related. And one of the stories I can wrap up this section of the talk with is in 1998, I got a great idea. A friend of mine, he at one time was married to my sister. By the time this was happening, they were divorced. And he and I had been friends in high school, and we had partied together. We called that partying, right? And he lived out in the desert, out in Lake Havasu, and he invited me to come out for a weekend of boating. And I don't know what boating means to you guys, but it's more like drinking, and then some boating, and then some more drinking, right? And so I went out there to see him, and you know, it's kind of a funny thing. Two of the terms that we use a lot to talk about alcoholics is you know, people that tend to be delusional or in denial, right? And I would characterize this as denial. I'm on my drive out to the desert, and I see billboards, and the billboards have a picture of a guy getting arrested, and on the sign it says, "Do not operate a watercraft and drink." And I see that sign, and I go, "That's good looking out, man. People should not do that." Now, that's exactly why I'm going there, okay? But I'm thinking, you know, other people shouldn't do that. Thank you. And as I get a little bit closer to town, I start hearing the radio ads, because now I'm getting into distance from the radio stations. And on the radio, they're running these ads that say, "Hey man, if you boat and drink this weekend, we're going to take you to jail." And I'm like, man, these guys are on top of their game. They got it going on. And that night, we got into town and we're at a bar. And on the TV screens, they're running these commercials. Okay, so now, I'm not seeing any of this. I mean, obviously I saw it because I'm telling you I saw it, right? But it didn't register. And the next morning, Saturday morning, we go to the grocery store to pick up the beer that we had intended to take on the boat with us.
And as I'm getting out of the car, we're walking towards the grocery store, I get this sick sort of feeling in my stomach like, this is a bad idea, don't do this, don't walk this way, turn around, go away, don't come here. But I'm not listening to that voice. And so we walk into the store and we buy all the beer that we want and we go and we rent the boat and we go out on the boat and we're out on the boat drinking and being stupid all day long. And get towards the end of the day, out in the desert out there. Lake Havasu, by the way, isn't a lake at all, it's a river. And any of you who are water skiers know that rivers are not as nice to ski on as lakes because you want the water to be flat. And out in the desert, the wind blows in the afternoon, and so we were driving around in 2-3 foot swells, right? So the height between the top of the cresting waves and the bottom of the cresting wave was about 2.5-3 feet. That is not skiing weather. Okay. Again, a little denial maybe, right? And so I jump in the water and my friend tows me around a little bit and I get up for a second and I'm drinking more water than I care to. So I get out and he gets in and so I start pulling him and he gets up for a minute and then he falls and I come back around and I got this great idea. Great idea, man. See, I'm gonna come back around to pick him up and just before I get to him, I'm gonna turn and throw this enormous wake of water at him. It's gonna be hilarious. You're gonna love it. Some of you heard this story before? Yeah, so it didn't turn out that way. What happened is, as I turned the wheel, I got this I had this really, really bad feeling in my stomach, and I didn't know exactly what had just happened, but I knew it was not good. And as I turned around and I looked, I saw my friend, and his head and shoulders were in the water, and the water around him was getting red, and the redness around the water was growing. This circle around him was getting big quick. And to this day, I don't know how I got the boat back over to him and got him on the boat. But I do remember, I still have the image of grabbing the life vest he was in and pulling him up and seeing what the propeller did to him. And there were 3 gashes. The top of his buttock was probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches long and 4 inches deep, and the next one went all the way across his buttock, probably about 8 or 10 inches long and 6 inches deep, and his hip bone was protruding from it. And then just below that was another smaller one, but also very deep cut, and there was blood everywhere. And I have to tell you that I've woken up in terrors at night with those images in my mind, knowing what I did to my friend. And we got him up on the boat, and I ripped this little tank top shirt thing that I had off, and I tried to compress the wound, and surprisingly, he was coherent for a little while, and then not so much. And we get the boat to the dock, driving like maniacs, 40 miles an hour through a no-wake zone that's really long, and we get to the boat dock, and I go to jump out of the boat to run to call for help, and it's at that point that I get a full gravity of just how intoxicated I am, because I can't walk. I'm so drunk, I can drive a boat, but I can't walk. You guys ever been that drunk, where you can drive, but you can't walk? So the ambulance comes eventually, and they take him away, and I don't know what's happened to him. I'm terrified. I'm afraid I've just killed this guy. And then the next set of lights shows up, and they're there for me. The sheriff came to pick me up, and now, mysteriously, my primary concern is what's going to happen to me. And that night in jail, I hope I never have to live through an experience like that again, because I had no idea what was to happen to my friend. And the next day was Sunday. I still don't know how this is possible, but somehow the judge came in and saw me on Sunday. I guess he saw how shook up I was. That's the only sense I can make out of it. And I guess he figured maybe I'd learned my lesson. And so he fined me, I think it was $600, and had to take a boat safety course and another night in jail, and then he released me. And
I told this story here once before a few years ago, and I never did finish that story. My friend did survive the injuries, thankfully. He's got some pretty deep scars, and among those scars, I'll get to a little bit later. The thing about it is that most reasonable people, after an experience like that, would say to themselves, "Wow, I got to quit drinking." I didn't say that. I was drinking the next night. I wasn't drinking the next night because I was afraid or scared, or I had no connection between the events and the drinking. I just didn't see any connection. And I know that sounds, how can you not see it? But I didn't. That was 1998. My sobriety date is April 11th, 2005. So I drank for 7 more years after that. And I did a lot more damage. The kind of damage that I would do is I would find a young lady who got my attention, and I would woo her with behavior that I was not willing to sustain. You know what I mean? I'd win her affections, and then I'd go back to the sustainable behavior. And then invariably at some point she'd say something really silly like, "I love you." And I would think, you don't even know who you're talking to. If you knew who I really was, man, you would be out of here in a heartbeat. I didn't know that though. But I know that now because I've done some inventory, and I know the truth about the way I've behaved. What I would do is I would just progressively come home drunker and later, and I would treat her with less and less respect and kindness. And I would put her in a position where she would have to begin to fear for her own physical safety. And not because I was necessarily causing her physical harm, but because I wasn't doing anything to physically protect her. And so I was a serial engagement partner. I use that word specifically because I've been engaged 4 times. I think it's 4. I've been married twice, and one of the 2 times I was married was clearly a hostage experience. I'll get to that. So I'm drinking, and my life is getting more and more out of control, and I can't see it. I don't see it. My friends are telling me, and I can't hear them. What happened to me is I began to get into this really severe depression and isolation cycle. So I would be at my home alone, drinking and using other substances for days and days at a time. I wouldn't know if anybody had come by or stopped. I didn't get out much except to get more supplies. And I began to lose weight. I got myself into a state of physical condition where my family could no longer deny what was happening. And I put them in a very difficult position. I put them in a position where they felt they had to confront me. I can be, I don't know, we like to use terms like a type A personality. I can be a very domineering person. I can be very loud. I can be very confrontational. I made people afraid to talk to me. And so my family was really worried about me, and they didn't know what to do next. And they solicited the input of somebody who works in the field of recovery, and they planned and carried off a perfect intervention. They got me at a moment when I was at my bottom, and I had I didn't know how to get off the merry-go-round I was on. They showed up at exactly the right time. And they sat around the table there, and they told me a bunch of really loving things about me, and then they gave me a very stern warning. They said, we love you. We're tired of watching you kill yourself. We will help you get help. But if you don't do that today, you're out. And what was harder than that was the execution of that. Because you know what happened is I took their offer. I went away for 30 days and I learned a lot of really important lessons. I learned a lot of good things. But as our book tells us, self-knowledge is not enough to get an alcoholic sober or to keep them sober for long. And neither is fear. And those were the two things I came home with. And I used to like to say I had about 30 days of institutional sobriety, but the truth of the matter is that I had conned and manipulated. I talked the girl that I was dating at the time into mailing my narcotic medications to the rehab place, and they doled them out because by law they were required to, and they kept telling me, this is a mistake. This is a mistake. This is a mistake. Don't do this. And you know, I'm a crafty guy, and my sister, who's here today, probably wants to beat me every time I think about this or talk about this, but she showed up to pick me up from the rehab place. She took time out of her family schedule to come and pick me up, you know, long drive away from here. And when she picked me up, I had managed to take what was left of the pill supply and get them out of her view, and I took six of them before we left the parking lot. So, you know, the truth of the matter is I didn't have any kind of sobriety at all. Not the way I understand sobriety today. And please understand, I'm not here giving you any kind of pitch about medication. I'm not telling you what you ought to do. I'm just telling you about me, okay? That's a very, very important point, by the way. So I get home and I run out of the pills and I get thirsty. Yeah. So I start drinking, and one of my friends is here tonight. He came over to my house and he tried to talk some sense into me. He said, "Dude, you just went to rehab. You know you got a problem. What are you doing?" And neither of us can remember exactly what I said, but I convinced him it was okay for me to drink that day. At least I thought I convinced him. I don't know, he may have a different point of view, but I gave a pretty compelling argument apparently. So that began this cycle of drinking and going to meetings, because the people that were around me, my mom and my sisters, they held up their bargain. They said, "Hey, you no drinking here, and if you want to see us," in fact, what I forced my mom to do, and this I forced her to do a lot of really unnecessary things, unfortunate things. One of the things I forced her to do was to tell her oldest child that if he wanted to see her, he would have to meet her at a meeting. Man, that's some black belt Al-Anon shit right there. My mom did that for me because that's how much she loves me. I didn't feel that way at the time, but she did that. And through the next several months, I would get sober for a minute, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd hear people talk about their lives and how they got better, and get sober for a minute, and I'd be on the way home, and you know, I'd just end up at a liquor store, man. I don't know. I had to go through all of those things, and I hate that I hurt the people who love me the most around me as I was going through it, but I had to go through those things because I had to learn something that's absolutely, positively imperative to know for me, and that is that I don't have what it takes to keep me sober. I didn't have it then, and I sure as heck don't have it today. I don't have what it takes to keep me sober. And you know, we were talking at dinner about these paradoxes, these comments that people say sometimes that seem to be in complete contrast, but yet they're both true, right? So how is it possible that I can't keep me sober and I haven't had a drink in 9 years? And I don't have one simple answer for that question. There's a lot of things. I got to a point where I was still on this plan of trying to keep myself sober, and it seemed to kind of work a little bit for a little while. And I managed to get 4.5 months sober. And I went out of town. I was still working at the time. I can't believe I still had the job I had, all the crazy behavior I was on. But I went out of town for a conference, and I was so impressed with myself because they had one of those hosted bars, and they had my favorite beer, man. And you know what I did? Even today, this is not really like me. I spent 40 of my own dollars to have a cab come and pick me up and take me to an AA meeting. I mean, man, I was rocking AA, man. I was Mr. Sobriety, right? I mean, that's lifelong sobriety right there. And so I thought, and so I went to this meeting, and I came back, and then I came back home from that trip feeling very good about myself. In fact, I felt so good about myself and my ability to keep me sober that I had made arrangements for my sponsor to take me to this oral surgeon. I was going to have my tooth replaced, and they were going to have to put me under the influence of a narcotic, which I didn't realize was a drug. Go figure. Missed that day in chemistry, I guess. And my sponsor, as I'm coming home on the flight home, he calls and says, "Hey, my daughter just had a baby." And I said, "Dude, I totally got this, man. I totally got this. Go be with your family. I'll be cool." And you know what the truth is I wasn't cool, because my body, and I'm not telling you anything about your body, okay? My body does not know the difference between a physician administered anesthesia and pain medications that are prescribed and other substances. My body just craves more of those things once you introduce it into my system. And I didn't know that. And so when I came out of this doctor-induced condition, I went to my grandmother's house for a couple hours, kind of shade and sleep it off. And then of course, you know, I can tell Grandma anything. "Oh, Grandma, I'm going to go home. I'm fine," right? And she doesn't know what to do with me, so I take off. And I go to the pharmacy because they've got this antiseptic rinse I've got to use. And, you know, I kind of feel just a little bit of a headache coming on. And you know, there were pain medications at the pharmacy. Now, my sponsor was going to pick those up for me, but I mean, I'm here. There's no reason to waste the trip. You know. So I got the pills, and I took twice the prescribed amount in the store before I left. And you know what I did next? I bought a case of beer. 4.5 months sober, down the drain. Because that's me keeping me sober. Can't be done, man. And I drank and used the narcotics that I had talked the doctor out of that weekend. Used them all. And on Monday morning, I went to the Alano Pub in Visalia because I had been doing that for about a year by then. Every morning I was going. It was a habit. I had no virtue. I didn't think, "Hey, I'm going to live the rest of my life sober." I just got up and went because that's what my body did. And I got to the meeting, and on the way to the meeting, I felt like this. I felt like 100 of those dentists, you know, the lead thing they put on you when they do the X-rays. I felt like 100 of those on me. And that was the truth. That was the lie that I was bearing. Right? I wasn't going to tell anybody. I'm still claiming my 4.5 months. And I get to the meeting, and you know, before the meeting's over, I'm crying in front of a bunch of people like you. And it's just a mess, man. And I had a great idea. I figured the solution to my problem was I was going to sign up with the Red Cross and go back to Louisiana and help with the Katrina effort. Yeah? Because that's what I needed to do to get sober. And obviously. And I don't know, you know. I don't know how it happened, but I let that plan slip out of my mouth. And one of the people at the meeting said, "Hey, dude, check it out. Why don't you just like volunteer to work at the Alano Club here? They need help here. And by the way, why don't you call your sponsor?" And I had this thing they called a sponsor. I'd had a few of them, but the guy that was working with me at that time, his name was Paul, and Paul had been offering some suggestions to me for some time. He'd been giving me these questions to answer, and I couldn't be bothered with all that.
I don't know why I took the advice, but I called Paul, and I was afraid Paul was going to tell me, you're a loser, you're a scumbag, get out of here, you loser, go get you another sponsor, I'm done with you. But that's not what he did at all. You know, what Paul did for me that day is he said, what do you want to do, man? What do you want to do? And I said, man, I'll do anything. I got to get sober. I'll do anything. And he said, well, you know, I hope you'll forgive me for being reluctant to jump on the Bill bandwagon here, but I haven't seen any evidence that you're willing to do anything. So you know what he did is he gave me an assignment. He said, he gave me some of the questions, again, same questions, and he said, what I want you to do is I want you to sit with a pen and paper every single night for no less than 5 minutes. I want you to write. And if you write more than 5 minutes, that's great, but I don't want you to ever write any less than 5 minutes. And I began to do that. And you know what started to happen is these little funny coincidences started happening, right? Through the journaling, I would find that the pencil had a mind of its own, and it would write things that just blew my mind. You know? And I need to be careful here, because every time I pick up a pencil, the truth doesn't come spewing out, right? I mean, sometimes I can really take us both on a tour, but oftentimes I would find things come out of that pencil, and upon reading them, I would go, wow, I had never thought of it that way. And I was listening a lot to speaker CDs and speaker tapes. And I think, believe it or not, my mom and my sisters had some Al-Anon tapes that they were listening to. And believe it or not, I think that's how I got to listening to speakers. And then I just got tuned into it. And I still listen to those damn things all the time. I just love listening to alcoholics tell their stories. And so I started getting these altered attitudes, these changed perspectives or perceptions of things. You know, one of the relationships that I really, really struggled with was with my father. And I felt for many, many years as a victim of my father. I felt that there was a great deal of violence between he and I growing up. When he showed up for that intervention, I felt betrayed, because I thought he'd been the one that had taught me how to drink the way I drank. I know today that's not the truth, but that's what I thought then. And I thought, how could this guy who's taught me how to drink be telling me my drink is a problem? And then when I went away to this recovery place, and they did a lot of different types of modalities of therapies, and they taught me a lot of useful things. One of the things that I remember being confronted with was some of that history with my father. And I got really angry as I thought about some of the things that happened between my father and I. And when I came back home, I mostly out of fear, I chose not to engage in a relationship with my father. I was afraid of him. I was afraid of what he might say or do. I was afraid of what I might say or do. I just was afraid. And I stayed away from him. And one of the things that happened for me was we like to say this, I'm working on a third step. You know what that means? It means I'm avoiding the fourth step is what that means. And I was avoiding the fourth step, and this guy Paul said to me, he said, man, come on, what are you going to do? Come on, let's do this. And he probably didn't say it that way, but he encouraged me to get on with the work. And I told him, I said, well, look, I've been reading ahead. And I see you down there, step 9, about making amends. And look, I'm just going to tell you, my dad is not ready to make amends to me yet. So no reason to hurry this process. And I'm so glad that my sponsor had some wisdom, and what he said was, hey champ, check it out, here's what we're going to do. Let's just worry about step 4 right now. And so we began a journey. The book is really confusing about the fourth step, I think. I believe it is confusing. Having had the experiences I've had now, it's not so confusing. But early on, I thought it was like written in Greek. I didn't know what the hell they were asking me to do. They write a list of names of institutions, people, institutions, and principals with whom you were angry. Well, I had no problem writing a list like that. But on the next page, it showed how you were going to put why, the cause, right? Why were you upset with these people? And then how they harmed you.
And as I put my dad's name on the list, I was thinking there was going to need to be a lot of space to write all of that before the next name. And I am not lying to you. I spent 4 months trying to figure out how much space to leave between the names. So I didn't write that list. And my sponsor, when he found out what I was doing, he said, "Look, dummy, just write the names. We'll write the names again later. Don't worry about it." And so we did that. And, you know, one of the things, one of the many things that I've learned as a result of going through the resentment inventory, and I think this is really important, is that the things that really, really anger me, even today, the things that really get underneath my skin that piss me off, you know what they are? They're the things that I don't like about me that I see in you. Yeah. Wow, look at that. And you know, part of that exercise of the four step gets me to identify that and then to shift it and say, okay, well, how have I done the things that I'm angry at this person about to them or other people? And I start saying, holy crap, man. You know, all these, I've been so angry at my dad for dominating me in conversation and not listening to me when I'm trying to tell him something that's important to me. And then I go, shit, man, I got 12 people I do that to. And that's why they say don't get rid of your four step, because you're going to need it when you get to your amends. It's part of the reason. And what this process of the resentment inventory has done for me is it's helped me to see that that I believe that I have fears that are based on lies that cause me to develop attitudes that drive me into actions that put me in a place where people have no other choice than to harm me. Like those women that I used to engage, right? I would woo them with all of this fancy behavior, and then I'd cut all that stuff off. And you know what? They would try so hard to get me to love them. And you know what? I refused. I refused to love them. I denied them my love. And you know what I forced them to do? They were left with only one thing to do. It was the only way you could hurt me was financially. And then I was a victim of them taking my money. And you know the thing is I set that up. I didn't give them any other choice. You know? But see, through that inventory, I get to see the truth. And that truth then allows me to begin to change my life. And, you know, I got to correct Gabe a little bit because I've been involved with his work. He said he's partly done through the fourth step. I want to tell you, this man has done more four-step work than most people I know. And he's on to the third inventory part of that, which is what we call a sex inventory. Doesn't that sound like fun? Don't you all want to do one of those? It sounds a lot different than what it really is. You know what it really is it's an opportunity to create a sound ideal for what I want my life and my partner in my life to be like. And my sponsor kind of tricked me again. He had me write down this list of all the qualities I wanted out of a partner in life. And you know, I had never done that before. You know what I always did? I said, well, you know, I want her hair to look like this and her bra to be that size and her... That's my shopping list, okay? And as I was forced to sit down and think about the things that were really important to me, I came up with things like, well, God, I want to be able to trust her with anything. I want to share common financial goals. And you know how I learned some of this? It's the hard way, by getting in relationships with people where I don't share common goals and values. You know, I want to have the same spiritual leanings. We don't necessarily have to believe word for word every single thing the same, but there's got to be enough commonality that we can worship together, and we can decide how much financial support do we want to provide to that spiritual entity that we're a part of, if we are, and we are, but you don't have to be. And so after I got all this list of all the things that she had to be, my sponsor turned that around to me and he said, well, now how are you matching up to this list? Because I hadn't been terribly trustworthy. I hadn't really been keeping to my own financial goals. Right? I had these ideas about how I wanted to do things, but then I didn't even keep my own ideas. And as I got into the fifth step and the fourth step,
the way I've gone through them are very much a part of the same work, right? There's not really a big dividing line between the two. And so then that led me into, you know, the sixth and the seventh step, and I just finished the seventh step again very recently. I get confronted with these lists of behavioral ideals that I fall short of. And you know, the funny thing about it is that I seem to think that I have some kind of control or power over the way I choose to behave all the time. And you know what? Instinctively, I react, and that's why prayer and meditation are so critically important to the life that I want to live today. You know, this week I've been home sick, and I haven't felt well. I mean, I've felt terrible all week. And see, I have this fear that if I don't do the work that I have to do for a profession, that somehow I'm not going to get what I need out of life. And so what I did is I'm sicker than a dog, and I'm answering emails and answering phone calls, and I'm treating people not with love. Right? Because I feel bad. Guess what? You're going to feel bad too. And I get to the end of the day, and I read some of the spiritual literature that I depend on today, and it reminds me that I really don't want to live that kind of life today. And so I have an opportunity to change the way I behave. I want to just wrap up with some final ideas, and that is, I think sometimes I get this notion that I know good from bad, right from wrong. I think I know what you need. I think I know what I need. And you know, more often than not, what I find, especially when things don't go my way, when things aren't happening the way I think they ought to, is if I'll just let it play out, I find out that that life kind of happens in a really nice way without my input sometimes. And so sometimes I get this notion, some guy like Dave or Phil or one of these guys that have blessed me with the opportunity to work with them in their life, to show them what I've been shown. I get the opportunity to speak into their lives, and I relate to them. I see me in them, and I get to see them change. But sometimes I think I know what they need. And sometimes they don't agree with my plan for their lives. Can you believe that? What I have found is that each and every one of us has our own path. And it's not up to me to tell you what path you need to be on. If I can be of service to someone and help someone, then that's my great blessing. And I couldn't think of a higher praise than Gabe gave me earlier today, to say that somehow, some way, out of the relationship that we've had, he feels he's gotten closer to God. Holy crap. Holy crap. To have that kind of influence. I mean, look, I don't think I did that, right? That was God doing whatever. But to be associated with that kind of comment, man, that's the kind of guy I want to be today. I want to be sure to do everything I can to make this program of recovery attractive to people. And I hope that I've done that in some small way tonight. Thank you.